The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Greetings to you. I'm Ben McKechin.
And so am I. Or Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 77 of The Big Picture for the week beginning July 20. And coming up on today's show, ready for a remake? We've got the Disney classic Pete's Dragon, updated for 21st century families.
Plus, a most beautiful story about the ugliest woman in the world.
And you'll never look at your webcam the same way again after watching privacy thriller Snowden.
Mate, I'm a little bit freaked out already about Snowden. You're going to get to that later in the show, this new film Olive Stone's directed about real-life issues to do with privacy and stuff. I'm a little bit concerned. To take us even further into fearful territory, Mark, what's happening at cinemas this week is, if you can believe it, this happened last Thursday. This is real. What I'm about to say actually happened. Blair Witch opened on Thursday. For anyone who wasn't around in 1999, you might not remember there was this little indie movie called The Blair Witch Project, which basically became an international phenomenon and kicked off everything from handheld camera being used often in films to it being one
too
of the
often.
That's right. And then it being one of the first big examples of online marketing and how successful that was for The Blair Witch Project. It's been remade. It's only been about 16 years. The original film wasn't that great. I'm not looking forward to the remake. I can't believe they've actually done it, but it's at cinemas now.
How can they do it if the whole thing is that this wasn't real and I don't even understand. The joke has been told, people.
I don't know, Mark.
Okay, well,
I don't know.
Speaking of jokes being told, this week on the ABC, We Want Our Country Back. It's a British expose on the new face of the race debate in Britain. And it's airing tomorrow night at 9:30 p.m. It's part of ABC2's Pride versus Prejudice Week, basically a whole week of programming on the whole issues of racism and such. And this documentary looks at the origins of the political party Britain First, a party that's emerged as a new name in the far right of politics. Among other things, it wants to ban all trace of Islam from the UK. And we're going to join its deputy leader, Yaida Franson, not a trace of immigration in that name, as she embarks on Britain's first national campaign.
Oh, also at cinemas, Mark, but a little bit closer to home, this opened on Thursday as well. There is a new Australian teen romance comedy drama called Spin Out.
Everything you want.
Everything you want, packaged into an Australian movie. And it is about a couple that are a ute driving stunt racing team, but then they have a falling out, a bit of love troubles off the track. That's what Spin Out's about. It stars Xavier Samuel, who I think a lot of people would remember was in Twilight. He was also in the recent Love and Friendship. He's a bit of an international star. He's come back home. He's in Spin Out. And for a parental flashback, you may remember, parents, or if you're of a certain age, that you might remember Tim Ferguson from Doug Anthony All-Stars. He co-wrote and co-directs this.
About utes.
Yeah.
Who would have thought?
Spin Out at cinemas now.
Well, Channel 10 fans, were you counting down to this Wednesday? I bet you were, because The Bachelorette begins again at 7:30 p.m.
It's back, yep.
There you go. This Wednesday, 7:30 p.m. There has been much speculation around the identity of Australia's next Bachelorette, and at last, we can reveal that it is Georgia Love. That's her name.
Really?
A journalist.
Really?
How's that for a last name? A journalist and nightly news presenter from Hobart.
Oh, yeah?
Her career has given her many great experiences, but has unfortunately taken her focus off the search for love.
Oh.
So, describing herself as your average girl next door, who incidentally hosts a statewide television program, Georgia has a warm personality and says, I want to find that one special person to share my life and all its ups and downs with, which I assume she's talking about the ratings for The Bachelorette. But anyway, it's on this Wednesday if you'd like to take a look.
Love on the search for love on The Bachelorette. Also close to home, Mark, Dame Helen Mirren is coming to Australia because she is starring in a new film called Winchester that's going to production next year. It's being backed by various producers in Australia, and it's about Sarah Winchester, who is the millionaire heiress to the Winchester Arms fortune, Winchester Weapons, who designed and built the renowned Winchester Mystery House. I didn't even know that was renowned, but apparently it is. It's all about her. Dame Helen Mirren, starring writer-director brothers Peter and Michael Spierig, are behind it. Helen Mirren will be here next year.
I guess all I needed to hear was Helen Mirren.
You had me at Helen Mirren.
Yeah. And is the Ocean's 11 franchise about to go where Ghostbusters dared to tread?
Yes, it is. Yes. I think I've heard this. Yeah. Yes.
Remaking a classic again with an all-female cast? You betcha. In pre-production at the moment is Ocean's 8, with some big names already signed up, Kate Blanchett, Sandra Bullock, and Anne Hathaway, to name a few. Produced by George Clooney, with no plot summary available at the moment. I guess I'm assuming there's going to be a heist somewhere.
Yeah, if you've seen any of the other Ocean's movies, I dare say it's very similar. Happen.
Only time will tell if dropping the guys for the drop-dead gorgeous girls will actually pay off. We'll mm-hmm. see.
Now, mate, before we get to what your kids are watching review for this week, Pete's Dragon, I believe you have a true or false statement for us.
Yes, yeah, speaking of Ghostbusters and other films that couldn't possibly go wrong, in a couple of weeks, Warner Brothers will release the new kids' animation, Storks, a story about those heavy-lifting birds responsible for delivering babies, or so my mother told me.
I think that's actually coming out this Thursday, this coming Thursday.
You're right, it is. Sorry
it's
about that.
It's even more imminent, Mark. It's almost here.
The imminent
It's almost
delivery.
Arrived.
The imminent delivery film. Anyway. That got me thinking about where babies come from, and so I decided to hit the internet and turn it up, in fact, some particularly disturbing facts. Well, for a squeamish man anyway. Ben, true or false? Every unborn baby grows a mustache in the womb.
out of the many true or false things that we have on the show, I really want that one to be true more than any other.
Can you picture it?
I can.
Hold it in your mind.
And I want that to be true.
Is it true? We'll find out after this. School holidays are just around the corner and some new releases have already been landing in our cinemas, aiming for the whole family's popcorn budget. For what your kids are watching this week, we picked Pete's Dragon for the all-ages crowd. Basically, it's a remake of a little-remembered Disney musical from the 1970s, and this Pete's Dragon, well, it's more realistic and less sing-along, and lights a family-friendly fire under why we believe what we believe.
How long has he been out there?
6 years.
Nobody can survive in that forest for 6 years. At least not alone.
You'll see. I have Elliot.
Who's Elliot?
I need to get back to him. He gets scared when I'm gone.
Is Elliot a person?
No.
He looks like a dragon.
What's a dragon?
How close is this to the Disney original Pete's Dragon?
Mate, I haven't actually seen the Disney original, and I think a lot of people didn't. So from what I understand of it, what I've seen online, read about, it's very different. It's no longer a musical. It's no longer featuring an animated, or at least the kind of classical style animation dragon. In this new Pete's Dragon, as you would expect, computer-generated dragon. It's a little bit like that Luck Dragon in the Neverending Story, just more green and with better special effects. And this film set in the real world as the original Pete's Dragon was, but it's just less cartoony all over, a lot more realistic in its look and feel and tone.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to say that I have seen the original Pete's
Dragon. Oh, you're the one?
Probably, yes, it's probably one of the few people. And I just want to say that I'm hoping it's not having the same effect, because the original Pete's Dragon was like one of those ultimate cheats that parents play on children, where they say, hey, we're going to the pictures. And then
Yay.
You get all excited, you sit down, and then you watch that. Okay, so I hope it's better than the first one. Yeah.
Well, on the scale of, then as it sounds from, based on your short terrible review of the
My
original Disney film.
Childhood.
On the scale of remakes then, Pete's Dragon sounds like it was due for one and has actually done a better job with it. It stars a young bloke called Oakes Fegley as Pete, who ends up living in the wilds of somewhere in Northern America, and he ends up befriending a dragon. And very early on, we discover this isn't an imaginary friend. This dragon is real. Somehow the dragon's been hiding in a forest. That's one of the things I was a little bit like, come on, really? Even kids, I think, might struggle a bit with, really? No one's seen the dragon? Apart from Robert Redford, who also is in the cast, who saw the dragon years ago, but apparently this giant dragon's been hiding out for however long.
Well, Robert Redford's very observant.
He is very observant, more than anybody else in the movie, including Bryce Dallas Howard as Grace, his daughter, who is like a park ranger, who gets involved with Pete. That Pete's kind of discovered living in the wilds of the forest, ends up talking a bit about Pete's his dragon, his mate, who looks after him and looks out for him. And a lot of the film is really to do with that situation that comes when people don't believe what you're saying. Also, people are freaked out by what they don't understand. And whether all of that's going to end up good or bad when we get to the conclusion.
Well, how does it handle the whole idea of actually believing in a dragon?
I found that pretty interesting, Mark. I like the fact that from the outset they demonstrate to you that the dragon is real. And so it kind of setting up a little bit the character like Bryce Dallas Howard, who I don't think she's like unreasonable in her dad's been talking about this dragon for years and years and years, and she sort of she wants to believe her dad, but also says just because you're saying something's true doesn't mean it actually is. And so the film is a little bit convenient in the fact that it does present this character, this creature that sounds fantastical and you know, completely made up as actually being real. But it presents the idea of believing in a dragon as something that someone a little bit on the fringe might believe in, but really, you know, if you kind of like dig in deep and hold to your guns, it might actually turn out to be true. One of the things I found kind of good and bad about this piece, Dragon Mark, is it does tackle the topic, or all topics it presents, really quite seriously. It's a little bit somber. I found the tone, the look of it, kind of glum and gloomy for a lot of it. Set in a forest, really quite dense at times, but just there's a real kind of melancholy, which, you know, is a big word for being kind of sorrowful, vibe going through Pete's Dragon that sometimes got in the way a bit of the adventurousness of it. And there's light and shade, sure, but I found it a little bit dark.
Yeah, you'd be expecting it to be one of those sort of classic kind of dog chasing things barking that Disney sort of comes out with. But
yes.
Look, this idea of outrageous beliefs being made believable. Okay, so people come to the idea that Pete's Dragon is real. How do you come to the belief, according to the Pete's Dragon, that something outrageously strange is in fact true?
Well, one of the things that's upheld in Pete's Dragon is that to believe in some outrageous claim, it often comes down to whether you trust the person that's making the claim or not. In this case, it's Robert Redford. He seems like a pretty trustworthy dude, and he's, you know, playing the dad of the Bryce Dallas Howard character. So, of course, she's going to, well, not of course, but you should be trusting in what your dad's got to say. So, Pete's Dragon overall is really sort of suggesting if you trust someone and what they're presenting as an outrageous claim, you might want to at least not dismiss it out of hand, which is That's an interesting outlook on when it comes to what we believe and how we go about believing it. So on the one hand, it's worth not dismissing someone, particularly if you trust them. I think there's something to be said, particularly as people say who are Christian and their friends might, you know, not really believe in what they're talking about. But if they find you to be a trustworthy person in your claims, they might actually listen to more of what you've got to say. And then at the heart of a lot of the claims in Christianity, what you're actually believing in, is what you're believing in trustworthy? So do you find God, Jesus, the claims that they've made, the promises they've given, are they trustworthy? If they are, you might want to put your belief in them, no matter how outrageous. Pete's Dragon conjured up those kind of thoughts for me as I was getting over some of the glumness of it, but also enjoying this kind of liberating imaginative experience of a boy hanging out with a dragon and just what impact that has on a small community.
Well, Pete's Dragon has flown into a cinema near you since its wide release last Thursday, September 15. It's rated PG for mild violence and stars Elliot, the dragon, Oakes Fegley, Bryce Dallas Howard and Robert Redford.
Mate, what's the answer to that, true or false? That
you
I'm hanging
know,
out for
you?
The answer.
Every unborn baby grows a moustache in the womb, true or false? It is true.
Oh, yes.
In fact, babies grow fine hair all over their bodies, doing a fair impersonation of a werewolf before they do a quick clean-up in time for the birth. So handlebar, moustache and everything. You know, the sort of thing that, like, you know, that whole idea, they get rid of this hair so grandma can say, what a treasure, when they're born, rather than, gracious, someone get a bonnet. You know, so there you go.
Whew. Mark, still to come, we're going to take a look at a moving documentary called A Brave Heart, which is about the quote-unquote ugliest woman in the world.
Welcome back. And imagine you are 17 years old and flicking through YouTube and you see a video titled World's Ugliest Woman. You click on it and discover you're the star of that video. And it gets worse when you read the nasty and aggressive comments. Kill it with fire. What a monster. Why didn't her parents just abort her? That happened in 2006 to Lizzie Velasquez, a Texan woman with a rare condition that means she has trouble gaining weight. For the past decade, Lizzie has been a prominent campaigner against bullying, including a TED Talk watched by almost 11 million people. For our press record segment this week, Ben spoke with Lizzie about her life and activism, which has been captured in a new documentary, A Brave Heart.
So as a child, before I started school, I had such a normal upbringing, much so that I had no idea I was different, none at all. It wasn't until my first day of kindergarten that I had the big reality check of maybe I am different, and that was due to other kids who were afraid of me, and they were scared to play with me on the playground or sit next to me during lunch, and I really couldn't understand because I still couldn't recognize that I didn't look like them. It didn't make sense to me because I was being really nice to them. And that's when I had to go home and really ask my parents, what's wrong with me? Did I do something? Why are they scared of me? And that's when they sat me down, and mind you, I was only 5 years old, and they explained to me that I look different and I'm a bit smaller than the other kids, but I'm just like them and I can do absolutely whatever I put my mind to.
Lizzie, how did you feel going through that, particularly when you were very young, but also going through middle school?
It's really hard, and there were times where I would really just wish and pray that when I would wake up in the morning, I'd look in the mirror and look like everybody else. At the time, it was unfortunate that my wish never came true.
Lizzie, you just mentioned praying, and you were raised in a Christian household. You're a lady of Christian faith. In those prayers, when you're talking to God, were you angry at God? Were you blaming God? What was your relationship like with God?
I was. I think my faith journey has definitely had a lot of ups and downs throughout my life. I didn't know who to blame, I guess you could say, for the struggles that I was going through. And I definitely couldn't blame my parents when I thought, well, I can blame God. And I look back now and see how absolutely wrong I was to do that, because every struggle, every single thing I've gone through has been such a huge blessing. And at the time, I just didn't see it. But looking back now, I realize that everything that I've experienced in my life has only made me stronger today.
Yeah, and you honestly believe that, Lizzie, because you're a person who has gone through levels of bullying and teasing that, like, I personally, I'm sure plenty of other people have never experienced in their lives. But you genuinely believe that a lot of these difficulties, these struggles that you've experienced, they are a blessing, and like a blessing from God?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely do. Because those things at the time seem horrible and awful, but now when I look back at it, I've learned so many different lessons. I've learned how to be resilient and how to be brave and courageous. And if I had this perfect life with none of those things happening, I wouldn't have learned all of these other things or all of these other qualities that I do have now. And I think that's true for everyone. It's just our perspective and the way that we sort of look at our own situation.
You've been at this for a while now, Lizzie, trying to get a positive message out there and also an anti-bullying message. But are you still a bit sad that the world can be a negative place and can still be a place where bullying happens a lot?
It's absolutely sad. And I went into doing the things that I do and the knowledge that, unfortunately, no matter what I say or do or what you say or do, bullying is never going to end, ever. But if we can continue keeping the conversation going, I hope that one day we'll be able to continue sort of this remedy that will hopefully one day lessen the amount of bullying that's happening.
If you're in a situation where you were face-to-face either with someone that's bullied you or someone who knows they've been a bully and is sort of trying to change their ways, what would you say to them?
First, tell them that I forgive them for whatever they're going through. And I hope that the forgiveness is something that can truly help them take the next step to move forward. I think they need to be reminded that they're not alone in whatever they're going through. And I hope I can offer them the safe place to be able to express what they're going through. And hopefully together we can find a more positive way for them to be able to get to the other side of whatever negativity that's going on in their life.
Why do you think forgiveness is so powerful?
Different for the individual. There's so many different reasons as to why it can help someone. But for me, speaking personally, forgiveness is something that allows you to move forward and doesn't keep you chained to whatever traumatic thing that has happened to you.
We just heard Ben's interview with Lizzie Velasquez, a Texan woman who has experienced cyberbullying to a degree few of us can fathom. Helping us to get an insight into Lizzie's life is A Brave Heart, a new documentary about the quote-unquote world's ugliest woman and her stand against bullying. Learning more about Lizzie's experiences and her response to them should challenge us all to consider how we see everyone around us.
The doctors had said they had never seen a child like that, and they didn't know exactly what was going on with her.
To me, she was already Lizzie. She was our daughter. She's tiny. It doesn't matter. She's our baby.
All we had known all my life was that I had a syndrome where I can't gain weight. At the time, I thought everyone looked like me. I couldn't recognize or tell that they didn't look like me. It was afternoon. I decided to go look for music on YouTube, and that's when I found it. I don't even know why I clicked on it, but I did, and that's when I lost it. Calling me a monster or asking why my parents didn't abort me.
Kill it with fire.
I wish you were.
What's the impact of a documentary like this, Ben? Is it deliberately shocking? I mean, is it even milking its own outrage? It's hard to know.
Yeah, you could kind of think that going in, given this is all about Lizzie, completely focused on her, and most of it is her or her family telling her story. So you might possibly be concerned that it's effectively trying to not just milk our outrage, but milk our emotions and really trying to manipulate us. But it doesn't. Bravehearts is good. It's not an amazing documentary. It's not trying to reinvent wheels. It's not trying to insert all kinds of different techniques and styles and stuff into it. Instead, it's just trying to tell somebody's story. And a story that, as we heard in the interview earlier, and as you could imagine, and you may have even watched Lizzie's TED Talk or just heard about her in the past, there's a big story to tell here. And you get a lot of it in this documentary. So I didn't find it deliberately shocking, but in terms of it trying to be manipulative, instead it's just shocking. And the deliberateness is trying to remind us as viewers about everything from the trauma that's inflicted from bullying, let alone just how we consider people, treat people, see people, how we judge people. It's a huge slap in the face on that. If you need to be woken up or shocked about that, about the prejudice and about the terrible ways we can treat each other, a Braveheart does that very, very easily.
Well, as you say, this is very much built around the dangers, the very modern danger of cyberbullying. What do we learn?
Well, I don't know if we learn too much that we shouldn't already know. And Lizzie Velasquez, again, as she says in the interview and she says several times in the documentary, she doesn't necessarily expect that bullying is going to disappear sometime soon, that we're somehow she or anybody else is going to be able to affect it. So what we learn about bullying, sadly, is that it remains a recurring issue. It's been seemingly kind of exaggerated or amplified by online elements. But really, it just goes back to the core of human hearts and how terribly we can treat each other. So in some way, a brave heart isn't really telling us anything that we don't already know. The things that we don't know, or you may not know, is about Lizzie and about her own response to bullying. And so one of the biggest reasons, I think, to catch a Braveheart, which is only available on DVD or on some streaming services. It's not hitting cinemas or anything like that. It's on small, limited release. One of the amazing things, Mark, you can take away from a Braveheart is just the response of Lizzie and her family to what happened to her at school and online, and how forgiving they are towards the people that did this to them. They're a Christian household. She's a woman of Christian faith. Her faith doesn't come through strongly in the documentary for anyone going in thinking this might be some kind of rah-rah Christian documentary. It isn't. It's in there in fits and starts. But really, there are a lot of elements about their faith that come through very strongly, particularly forgiveness.
Yeah, I was going to think in terms of the value of life, I expect that must emerge to some degree.
It does.
Yeah, when you've got people writing comments like, you know, you should kill yourself on the video and stuff like that, I guess we get a whole
isn't
other
that amazing
picture
people.
Yeah, how people see each other.
That's right. It's amazing people will even write that stuff, let alone where that comes from and thinking about the impact on others. But you're right, going back to kind of this core issue that emerges from a Braveheart, or sort of put in a spotlight by Braveheart, is how we value each other and each other's lives. For anyone who's got an understanding in God, of God and Christianity and Jesus, and how that means you work out that each individual person is placed on this planet by God, and that there is a genuine relationship sought by God with them, between them and God, and them and other people, a real communal relational focus to this human existence. And then also all the components that go into each individual person doesn't mean they're of less value than anybody else. God loves everyone equally, and that should in turn lead on to us being able to love each other. It's just a massive reminder of that. It's like a walking, talking parable, a Braveheart, of what something we all should already know, I think. So everything from the effects of bullying to this great reminder of there is such immense value in everyone's life that it should challenge me and everybody else to consider how we go about living that out, and do we live that out, and could we be living that out better?
Okay, well, A Braveheart is rated PG for mild themes and coarse language, and is centered on Lizzie Velasquez. You can head online, in fact, to imwithlizzie.com.au be the easiest place to check it out. That's imwithlizzie.com.au to find how you can purchase the DVD or get it digitally through iTunes, Google Play, Sony PlayStation, and lots of other distributors.
Yeah. Mark, still to come on the show, from cyberbullying to cyber surveillance, there is a new real thriller that will freak you out about who is watching us all the time. Welcome back to the show. In an age where computers are constantly crawling over every piece of information we put online, is it any wonder that we worry about what's left of our privacy? But what if you learned that government agencies were deliberately prying into our PCs even when they're turned off? That's the mind-numbing assertion behind the real-life thriller Snowden, based on the true story of NSA employee Edward Snowden, who leaked thousands of classified documents to the media. This Oliver Stone-directed drama holds out the secret to happiness in a world where everything we're doing can be known by someone else.
The NSA is really tracking every cell phone in the world.
Most Americans don't want freedom. They want security.
Except people, they don't even know they've made that bargain.
Are they watching us?
There's something going on inside the government that's really wrong, and I can't ignore it. I just want to get this data to the world.
Hey.
I feel like I'm made to do this, and if I don't do it, then I don't know anybody else that can.
Snowden is basically the story of Edward Snowden, the NSA employee. In fact, he was a contractor at the time who dumped huge amounts of information into the laps of the world media, letting them know just how much surveillance the American government was partaking in, not simply overseas, but actually in its own country. In fact, an interesting stat comes out during the film talking about how 60% or so of everything that America is looking at is tracking its own citizens, you know, as if somehow they were more of a danger than someone outside of their own country. Anyway, basically, we pick up Snowden when he's in college and has he's being sort of led to the trough of international espionage based on sort of technical, you know, computer uses and programs and things like that, and how he starts to drink the Kool-Aid and think this is pretty much a good idea and the right thing to do, but eventually the whole thing sours in his mouth and he realizes what he's doing is not simply deconstructing the freedom of people, but deconstructing his own right to privacy and, in fact, safety in a world that's gone mad with needing to know what other people know about you.
Snowden's coming out at cinemas this Thursday. Do you reckon people are going to flock to it? Are they actually going to rush out to see this kind of movie?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those films where I wish they would. Okay, for a start, it's going to get a fair amount of people just on the basis that Snowden is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
It's always one of those names where I think to myself, I've just said it and maybe I got it wrong. But look, he's actually quite a good actor and does quite a good job. And in that respect, I think it's going to be a great watch. But to that degree, I think people probably should see this film because it's been made possible by other films. So Benedict Cumberbatch in The Fifth Estate.
The movie about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks fame.
And in fact, the doco about Julian Assange, Underground, and all sorts of things like that have turned our eyes towards what's going on online in regards to privacy. Mm. So I figure that'll drag some people along too.
Sort of cyber whistleblowers. But what's the effect of someone like Oliver Stone telling this story? Now, a lot of people may not know Oliver Stone or remember his name as much. He was a lot bigger in sort of the 80s and the 90s. He made films like JFK, Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Natural Born Killers. Very provocative films and often weighing in very heavily on political and social matters, which sounds like that's all coming together in Snowden. But like he did a couple of years ago with World Trade Center, and on the last week's show, if you go and listen to the podcast, you listed off top five September 11 related films. You mentioned World Trade Center, Oliver Stone directed that one. But with that one, he was very kind of neutral, somber, or very sensitive. So which approach is Oliver Stone taking to Snowden here? Is it more like the provocative JFK or more like the playing your cards close to your chest, respectful World Trade Center?
I'm going to put a bet either way, because firstly, you definitely come out of this film freaked out. Okay, you cannot look at your webcam the same way again after you've watched Snowden. In fact, I came out and I thought to myself, I really do need to put some masking tape over that thing.
Oh, okay, all the time, even when your computer's off. And
the revelations as to what they are actually capable of doing with that electronic device, which is basically a portal into your life, were incredible, stunning, to the point where I was just
So is Oliver Stone and this is film Snowden trying to freak us out?
Yes. So in that degree, that's my first bet. On the one side, he is taking a very strong view on the threat to privacy in the world today. Yet on the other side with Snowden, I don't know. I spent.
You mean the character of Snowden, the figure of Edward Snowden?
Edward Snowden. I guess I kept waiting for the light and shade in that character. I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. He was a nice guy, and he learned that bad things were happening. And as a nice guy, he couldn't tolerate that, and it was affecting his own marriage and his health. And so, as a nice guy, he decided to do something about it. And he's just a nice guy.
So it's almost a problem that he's a nice guy.
Well, I guess it's because there's just no depth to the character.
That's one dimension nice, and you are actually looking for more.
Yeah, and weirdly, I wasn't sure if I believed it completely.
Mm.
And so that's, you know, weirdly something that acts against the film. That said, I'm not trying to say anything negative about Edward Snowden's character. The man is, you know, for that matter, he's made himself a pariah for the sake of our own privacy. So I really respect that. But just the balance of character within it didn't quite strike me as realistic. And so it looks a little worshipful, you know, from Oliver Stone there.
Yeah, so what about this lingering feeling of fear that you've mentioned a couple of times? So our privacy is being invaded, we're being betrayed. That seems to be the message of Snowden that I'm getting from you, that we need to keep our cameras secure or switched off all the time. Is that the take-home message? Basically, like you said, put the masking tape over your camera on your laptop. The end, that's it. That's all we need to learn.
Well, it's kind of, to some degree, we've got to take action. That's the feeling that you actually get out of the film. And to that degree, I love one of the lines in the film where Snowden's character actually says, you know, everybody wants to be happy. There's a certain weight and desire to remain happy. And once you're happy, you don't want to become unhappy. So it's easier to do nothing. And I think it's important that the film says, you know, actually, we've got to take action. We've got to be concerned. But the interesting thing that hit me as a Christian as I was watching it is everybody was getting really, really freaked out about the idea that people could peer right into your life and know your most innermost secrets and know what you were doing in the privacy of your home.
Oh, as if someone was watching you all the time.
I know. And yet as a Christian, we grow up with the idea, or if you've grown up as a Christian, or certainly if you become a Christian, you accept the idea that God knew that all along. That in fact, there is someone who knows everything much better even than the NSA, who actually knows what you're thinking and what you actually meant when you said something and why you were actually doing something. Your motives are completely exposed before God, and you need to deal with that information. And it's not by running away. It's not by saying you shouldn't do that. It's actually by accepting certain things about ourselves. So personally, I feel like it was a good reminder as a Christian that, you know, I don't have to hide if I have dealt with the problems I have in my life. The only way to deal with them is to give them to God, let him deal with them through the sacrifice of Jesus. But personally, if I just keep running, or if I keep saying you shouldn't look, like Snowden seems to suggest, then in all honesty, I'm not really dealing with the problem at all.
Snowden is directed by Oliver Stone, stars Shailene Woodley, Scott Eastwood, Nicolas Cage, and of course, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It's rated M for coarse language and a sex scene, and opens nationally at cinemas this Thursday, September 22. Well, Mark, I was about to dive in and explain how we've just gone from talking about cyber surveillance and being freaked out to Bridget Jones' Baby.
Indeed. And as we mentioned at the head of the program, this week marks the release of Bridget Jones' Baby. The Bridget Jones saga that has become something of a mascot for women of the new millennium, keeping mum at bay, keeping in touch with friends, and all the while on the hunt for the perfect job and the perfect Darcy. So we thought it's worth acknowledging that the third film has finally come out. We thought we'd devote this week's soundtrack segment to Bridget Jones' franchise and its fan club by playing something from the latest soundtrack, Hold My Hand by Jess Glynn.
Standing in a crowded room and I can't see your face. Put your arms around me, tell me everything's okay. Rising tide.
So, Mark, we just played Jess Glynn's Hold My Hand because that is featuring in the new Bridget Jones Baby, the third Bridget Jones film that hits cinemas on Thursdays. I don't know too much about Jess Glynn apart from she's got massive in the last couple of years, British singer. But I read a cool article online that I tend to agree with in terms of this song, Hold My Hand, being something of a summary of the whole Bridget Jones character and Bridget Jones vibe, which is basically those lyrics about I'm ready for this, there's no denying, would suggest a confidence and assurance to a sassy single woman trying to live her life. At the same time, she's ready for someone to hold her hand and doesn't want to walk on her own anymore. And Bridget Jones, as most people would know, is often desperate for someone to share her life with, be it a partner or be it a baby. So yes, Hold My Hand does seem like a pretty good choice for Bridget Jones' Baby.
Yeah, well, Bridget Jones' Baby is rated an unsurprising M for sexual references and coarse language, so be warned, it's not as innocent as Hold My Hand. It opened nationally at a cinema near you last Thursday.
From Bridget Jones' Baby to, this is what's coming up in the show, Mark, what the Bible has to say on family and the top five strangest families in film history. Will your family be one of them? Welcome back to the show. Before the break, we were talking about Bridget Jones' Baby. It hit cinemas last Thursday. It gets us thinking a little bit about family and the biological unit that you grew up in to the friends you collect around yourself as your life moves on. But do they all stand on an equal footing? And who are we to judge? Well, better to hand that job over to the Bible, and we'll let Bible Society CEO and social commentator Greg Clark do the daring job of digging out the answer for us on what the Bible has to say about family.
Listen to what the Bible says about families. In Ephesians 3:14, it says, "For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name." Well, if you think your family is odd, have a browse through the pages of the Bible and you will feel much more normal. Many people make the mistake of thinking the Bible is like a phone book of morals, a kind of list of do's and don'ts about how to live. But in fact, the Bible is full of the amazing stories of the lives of people in what we now call the Middle East, ranging from 2 to 4,000 years ago. And it's more like a family history than anything else, and some of these families are pretty wild. Take the first family described in the Bible. Adam the husband and Eve the wife. One of their sons, Cain, kills his brother Abel. And Mum talks Dad into disobeying God together in the infamous apple-eating scene. If you haven't read it, look at Genesis chapter 1. Or King David, the great leader of Israel, who sleeps with his neighbour's wife and then has the man killed in battle. Well, his own son, Absalom, does the same back to Dad, sleeping with his concubines, but is himself killed. Talk about a tragic soap opera. And the family of Jesus himself, a very young mother, suddenly pregnant, her partner claiming he has not slept with her, so the baby must be divinely conceived. Well, these are all real-life stories about real-life people, and it's messy. The Bible isn't praising the bad behaviour of any of the people I've mentioned, but it is acknowledging that life is complex, that family is complex, and we shouldn't rush to judge anyone's own situation. How do you know what God has in store for that mad and crazy family? But on the other hand, the Bible is very helpful in guiding us about what sort of families assist human flourishing. A husband should love a wife, says the Bible. In fact, a husband should lay down his life for his wife. A wife should respect her husband and be his best advocate. Children should honour their parents. You see the pattern here? It's asking for respect for each other, for care, love, sacrifice, and devotion. In fact, the pattern for human families is found in the nature of God himself. As our Bible verse teaches us, human families take their guidance from God the Father, who loves us more than we realise or accept, and wants all of his children to come to him for safety and for salvation. God is the pattern for what human families should be.
Greg Clark, Bible Society CEO and social commentator. And speaking of the Bible Society, who are also those wonderful people behind Eternity Digital. And now, I'd actually like to draw your attention to the Eternity Digital website just before we go this week, because Mark Yarhouse, one of Christianity's foremost experts on sexual identity and gender, has spoken to Eternity about gender dysphoria and how ministry leaders can respond to that. So if you're looking for the article, it's "Distress of Gender Dysphoria Should Be Met with Compassion," says expert. And you can find it at eternitynews.com.au.
Also, a big supporter of the show is Insights magazine and websites. If you go to insights.uca.org.au, not only, Mark, will you find weekly commentary on what's out there in the world of film and TV, but you'll also find other pieces of social commentary, such as an article I wrote called "Caring About Caring," where I was admitting to everybody in the world that will happily read what I was writing, which is basically I suffer a bit from compassion fatigue. I can feel a little bit overwhelmed by what I should care about, but should I just stop there, or should I pursue some other course of action to deal with my lack of caring about caring? Find out what the answer is at insights.uca.org.au. Mark, end of the show, and we are finishing on something of a family note this week. Seemed to have been kicked off in our thoughts by Bridget Jones' Baby being at cinemas. Family, family, family. And so what way could we take a top five list other than strangest families on film? So to take it away.
Five.
Mrs. Doubtfire, 1993.
Oh, yes, is a lovable family, if ever there was one.
Yeah, a movie I don't really like that much, which I know makes me a little bit of a hater, because loads of people like Mrs. Doubtfire. I found it not that funny, a little bit shrill and annoying, but loads of people loved it. I admit that. Loads of people loved it. And they really seem to love the idea of Robin Williams as Daniel, this unreliable dad who gets booted out of the family home by Miranda, played by Sally Field, his long-suffering wife, and she's looking for a divorce at the end of their separation. So how are you going to go about proving you're a good dad? Well, according to Mrs. Doubtfire back in 1993, you dress up as a woman, and not just any woman, a robust English housekeeper, a little bit like Mary Poppins in drag. That seems to be the solution in this weird, strange family unit going on in Mrs. Doubtfire. And the upshot, well, one of them is you can win an Oscar for best makeup, if you can believe that. That was one of the things that Mrs. Doubtfire achieved.
Oh, there you go.
Four.
Okay, Mark, from Mary Poppins in drag at the center of a bizarre family unit to another strange family unit. Honorable mentions before I get to who I picked. Go to Coneheads. Remember that movie with Dan Aykroyd as an alien family landed in the world? And apparently people didn't seem to notice that that weird an alien family, even though, as it says in the title, their heads were cone-shaped. Or The Clumps, that Eddie Murphy film where he basically played every member of his family. They were larger people and very offensive and aggressive and all kinds of things.
The only jokes were flatulence jokes.
Oh, my goodness, The Clumps. No, instead of that, those strange families, I instead went for another weird brood, the Cullen family in the Twilight saga, which kicked off in 2008. Because we're talking about a bunch of adopted, seemingly informally, I think that's a polite word, informally adopted children, at least teenagers.
I.e. converted to vampires by your parents.
But the strange thing about them, that's right, is that they're sparkly. Some of them are really fast. They're ageless, immortal. They're blood-sucking. They just go to high school forever. Some are really strong, and some can see the future, and some can just pout for eternity.
Now, just a note. If in any way a family next door to you does sparkle, we're not suggesting that they're vampires, but we're also saying just be a little cautious.
They also might be. So, yeah, number four on my strange family list, I think, just has to go to the bizarre brood that was going on, and the bizarre brood in the Cullen household, and just, like, how could you not feel strange about living next door to vampires?
Three.
2001's The Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, I love this family.
Finally, we get to a movie, A, that I really liked, and B, that's a more sophisticated look at a strange family, I think. Honourable mention goes to Little Miss Sunshine, which I think has the same kind of blend of kook and quirk.
Dysfunction.
And dysfunction and despair, and then moments of great joy that, you know, often can be part of all of our family lives. I'm not sure if... your family, Mark, is anything like the Royal Tenenbaums family. My family certainly isn't. Even at our worst moments, we don't really have this strangeness going on that you see constantly in the Royal Tenenbaums. So, and which largely seems to be kind of influenced by the father, Royal Tenenbaum. That's his actual name, played by Gene Hackman. Excellent role. And the Royal Tenenbaum seems to be a movie largely about the impact a father has had on his family and how that plays out across the lives of his children, particularly into their adult life. And so you get Ben still playing Chaz, who was a math and business genius as a kid, and he becomes this really overprotective dad in matching Adidas tracksuits with his boys as an adult. Gwyneth Paltrow has an adopted daughter, Margot, who is a playwright, but is quite constantly suicidal thoughts for a lot of her life. And then you get Luke Wilson as a tennis prodigy who, as an adult, keeps wearing a tennis headband, striving for the love of his dad, and also strangely trying to express his feelings for his adopted sister, Margot. All of that swirling around with Angelica Houston playing Royal Tenenbaum's wife. The director of this, Wes Anderson, think most of his movies are about family, and particularly when it comes to fathers and kids relating. But this one, I think, stands out particularly for the strangeness of it, but also how strangely appealing the characters are, even Royal Tenenbaum.
Yeah, and just by the way, this is a family you do want to live next door to on account of the fact that they just make you feel so good about what's going on inside your own home. Two.
Mark, this... I've been struggling to work out how to actually explain this choice, but I'm just going to try to dive straight into it. I'm not picking one movie, I'm picking two, but I'm picking a star of both of those movies.
Okay.
For both of these.
For a bizarre family.
For both of these combined, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because in 1988...
Any family that included Arnold Schwarzenegger would be a strange family. I understand where you're going.
I'm not in any way having a go at Arnold Schwarzenegger personally, Mark, as you just did.
You wouldn't. Instead, the man is built like a tank.
That's
Why
right.
Why would you?
Instead, I'm very kind of shocked and puzzled by some of the characters he's played in the two films in particular. 1988, Twins, where he...
Danny DeVito.
They were Danny DeVito. And maybe people nowadays don't remember Danny DeVito, but I'd imagine a lot of people still do. I hope they do. But the basic thrust of that film, Twins in 98, was Arnold Schwarzenegger is massive and Danny DeVito is pint-sized, and somehow they were twins. And then a couple of years later, still also starring Danny DeVito and directed by Ivan Reitman, who made the original Ghostbusters, who was a bit of a comedy powerhouse at the time. 1994, Junior came out, and this sort of upped the ante in the family stakes. So if you thought Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger were a strange brother unit, a strange family unit, Junior had Arnold Schwarzenegger pregnant.
As dad.
As
and
a
mom.
Dad.
And mom.
As dad and mom, that's right.
In one.
So talk about a strange family unit. So number two on the strange family list, I think, had to go to Arnold Schwarzenegger. I didn't even mention Kindergarten Cop.
Wow.
In all of that. But I think for being the brother of Danny DeVito...
It's not a tumor, by the way.
And as you said, a mother and a father in the same movie, he had to come in at number two.
One.
I'm really kind of keen to know what is your most bizarre movie family.
Yeah, I really wanted to try to pick something that wasn't where I'm going to go.
I mean, there's
I ended
an
up.
Obvious contender.
I think there is. And don't you think that obvious contender is the Addams Family?
Of course.
The
it's
Addams
a family,
family
that's actually been sent forward... The Addams Family.
Yeah,
yes.
And they're creepy and kooky and mysterious and ooky and altogether spooky and whatever that the song was from the original TV show. But the 1991 film version did a great job of rendering this bizarre, ghoulish, like faintly supernatural and creepy and just odd family, and yet give them some warmth and heart in a way that you wouldn't necessarily expect from a household that has everything from a life-size guy who's got hair down to the ground to giant
Cousin
Lurch.
It.
Cousin It. That's right. Cousin
Lurch the Butler.
And Lurch the Butler. And then Thing the Hand, the
yeah.
dismembered hand that walks around, let alone Morticia and Gomez Adams' relationship. And then Wednesday being that sort of sullen, seance-y kind of kid roaming around the house. They're just strange, right?
Not so strange. Every family has an Uncle Fester. Well, no. Seriously, every family has that uncle somewhere
no,
on the side.
No, they don't. However, I think what the Addams Family does...
I come from the South Coast, mate.
I'm going to back away from that comment and instead just say that, however, following on from that, the Addams Family and this whole list of top five strange families, I think if it reminds us of anything, it hopefully will remind us that our own family is nowhere near as strange as many up on screen.
Father, what is it?
It's an Addams.
He has my father's eyes.
Gomez, take those out of his mouth.
He's an adorable little baby.
Fine, rub it in.
Children, why do you hate the baby?
We don't hate him. We just want to play with him.
Especially his head.
You'll meet someone, someone very special. Someone who won't press charges.
You know, I love that about the Addams Family because even though they seem dysfunctional, in their own storyline, they are the most functional family.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, people look at Christians that way. They sometimes go, oh, you're such a dysfunctional bunch. No. Functional, trust me.
On that note, that ends our show. But what's coming up next week, Mark?
Well, ready for a little freestyling inner city truth-telling?
I am.
We bring you the rap sensation, The Get Down.
Oh, yeah. And the Magnificent Seven are back again in The Magnificent Seven.
Who would have ever thought? And plus, we can finally tell you where babies come from, thanks to Warner Brothers Storks.
Mate, I'm really looking forward to hearing about The Get Down. Next week, though, I won't be a white boy rapper. I'm just going to be Ben McKechnie.
I will be the one who tells you where babies come from. I'll be Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.